This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The recent death of composer and lyricist Stephen Sondheim marked the end of an era. He died Friday, November 26th, at age 91. It's hard to overestimate his influence on American musical theater. He started his Broadway career writing lyrics for West Side Story and Gypsy, and went on to write music and lyrics for such shows as A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, and Passion. He was the child of classic Broadway. His mentor and father figure was lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. But Sondheim opened the door to something new on Broadway. Some of his songs had inventive structures that didn't adhere to familiar song forms and were built on harmonies resembling the classical avant-garde. Some of his musicals, like Sweeney Todd, were sung through like operas, although Sondheim was adamantly opposed to calling them operas. If the groundbreaking nature of his work sounds familiar now, it's in part because so many composers have emulated him. Sondheim won Tonys, an Oscar, Grammys, and a Pulitzer, and was awarded a Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Obama. But some of his great works were flops when they opened, including one of my favorites, Merrily We Roll Along. If you're a regular Fresh Air listener, you probably know that I, along with many others on our Fresh Air team, love his music. I was fortunate in having interviewed Sondheim several times. Yet when people ask me who I was most nervous to interview, I usually say Sondheim, because he's my musical hero, but I always got the impression he didn't like being interviewed. If he didn't approve of the way I phrased a question, or if a word I used struck him as imprecise or inaccurate, he let me know. The first time I interviewed him in 1988, he came to our Philadelphia radio studio because he was giving a lecture as part of a series at the University of Pennsylvania. Apparently, he thought the interview would be about that university series. So when he found out the interview was going to be about his music, he wanted to leave, literally. I did my best to explain what his music meant to me and how I hated to make him uncomfortable. But he was that day's interviewee, and if he left, we would not have a show. He stayed, but I think he remained uncomfortable. I was sorry grateful. Soon after, he sent a note apologizing, along with what I think of as the best consolation prize ever, a cassette recording of his famous appearance at New York's 92nd Street Y Lyrics and Lyricists series, a recording that wasn't available to the public. After he died, I listened back to that interview we did, and despite his reticence, his comments about his music were fascinating. Hearing him talk about his music was always illuminating. So let's begin our tribute with the first of two interviews I recorded with him in 2010, the year the music world celebrated his 80th birthday. We started with the opening song from the first show for which he wrote the words and music, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. It opened in 1962 and starred Zero Mostel.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with kings, nothing with crowns. Bring on the lovers, liars, and clowns. Old situations, new complications, nothing portentous or polite. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight.
Stephen Sondheim, welcome back to Fresh Air. Are you surprised to find yourself in the position as like the elder genius, since it seems like you spent so much time as like the really young, brilliant guy? You know what I mean?
No, I think of myself as 18 years old, so, you know, I'm only surprised when I look in the mirror. No, I'm, as far as I'm concerned, I'm 18 and very promising.
In the Roundabout Theater production of Sondheim and Sondheim, you say that people assume that a lot of your songs are really autobiographical, but they're not, with the exception of Opening Doors from your 1981 show, Merrily We Roll Along. And I saw a revival of the show a few years ago. It didn't last long, sadly, on Broadway. But I saw a revival by the York Theater Company?
Yes.
It was wonderful. I love the show, and I love the songs from the show. So I want to play Opening Doors, and then I want to talk a little bit about it. And
okay.
Do you want to describe where the song fits into the story?
The song takes place over a period of 2 years in the lives of the three leading players who are in their late 20s. And two of them are songwriters, a lyricist and a composer. And their best friend is a woman who is a young woman who is a budding novelist. And it's the three of them trying to break into, well, the two guys into show business. And she's trying to finish writing a book.
So this song is at the point where they're kind of hoping to become real,
real
composer,
right. Yeah,
or real lyricist, and a real novelist.
They're opening doors.
They're opening doors.
And
we're going to hear the song by, in the original cast recording, sung by Jim Walton, Lonnie Price, and the part of the producer who interjects in the middle here will be sung by Jason Alexander, who played George on Seinfeld. So here we go, from Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along.
Bum, bum, ba, da, 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 da. How's it coming?
Good, you?
Done.
1 minute.
Amber Devin.
Hi.
Mary.
Say hello.
I got another job.
Where?
Me.
What's that?
A brand new car to pop up pictures.
What about the book?
What about the book?
Did you give the publisher the book?
Yes.
Good.
No.
Mary.
Finished.
Let me call you back.
Right. This is just a draft.
Right.
Probably it stinks.
Right.
I haven't had the time to do a polish.
Will you sing?
Right. Who wants to live in New York? Who wants the worry, the noise, the dirt, the heat? Who wants the garbage cans clanging in the street? Suddenly I do. They're always popping their cork. I hate that line. The cops, the cabbies, the sales girls up at Saks. You gotta have a real taste for maniacs. Suddenly I do.
That's great. That's swell. The other stuff is well. It isn't every day I hear a score this strong. But fellas, if I may, there's only one thing wrong. There's not a tune you can hum. Not a tune, you go bum 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 da dum. You need a tune to go bum 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 da dum. Give me a melody. Why can't you throw them a crumb? What's wrong with letting them tap their toes a bit? I'll let you know when Stravinsky has a hit. Give me some melody. Ah, sure, I know it's not that kind of show. But can't you have a score that's sort of in between? But play a little more, I'll show you what I mean.
Wants to live in New York. I always hated the dirt, the heat, the noise, but ever since I met you, I...
Listen, boys, maybe it's me, but that's just not a hum of a mum of a mum of a melody. Write more work hard, leave your name with a girl. Less avant-garde, leave your name with a girl. Just write a plain old melody.
Opening Doors from Merrily We Roll Along by my guest Stephen Sondheim, who said this is his really autobiographical song. So is the part autobiographical where the producer complains that it's not a song you can hum, give me a melody?
Sure. But it's autobiographical in the general sense. It's, first of all, I didn't have a collaborator. I mean, it's not specifically autobiographical. I wrote my own lyrics, my own music. The girl is merely an amalgam of people like, particularly, I was very close to Mary Rogers, Dick Rogers' daughter. She became a composer as well as a novelist, as a matter of fact. And of course, Hal Prince, who was a producer and then eventually a director. We were all very close to each other. It's not specifically based on us, but it's on the ambience of our lives and the speed and the excitement and the disappointment and the triumph, etc.
Now, the producer sings, I'll let you know when Stravinsky has a hit. He sings sarcastically. Now, you studied with the avant-garde composer Milton Babbitt.
Mm-hmm.
When you studied with him, was your ambition Broadway or was it more...
Oh, no, I always wanted to write songs. Well, he's a songwriter manqué. I wanted to learn compositional technique, and that's what I learned from him. But we would we had 4-hour sessions once a week, and we would spend the first hour analyzing songs by, Jerome Kern or by De Silva Brown and Henderson, the classic songs of the American theater and American movies. And Milton also, he wrote songs. Most of the time, he wrote these extremely forward-looking pieces. He was writing electronic music before anybody ever knew that electronic music existed. And but he had this one foot in fact, he's a jazz fan. And he's also got the kind of memory, if you play him a jazz record from 1932, he'll tell you who is playing what instrument. He's remarkable that way. But what we did was we spent an hour, you know, on, you know, songs, and then 3 hours on Beethoven and Bach. And it was all about essentially compositional analysis. But no, I only wanted to write songs. I didn't want to write concert music.
Can you give me an example of an insight you got from Babbitt studying, say, a Jerome Kern song?
Yeah, well, but I'd have to do it with a piano. One of the things we analyzed in detail, one of the songs, was All the Things You Are, which has a remarkable harmonic structure in it, which, among other things, consists of the fact that the tonic chord isn't played until the end of the song, and it goes through a circle of fifths and then breaks the circle of fifths with a tritone, which echoes itself not only in the melody but also in the bass and defines both the key that the song is written in and the key to which it's going, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've actually reproduced that hour-long analysis he gave me to students I had at Oxford when I taught at Oxford. It's lodged in my mind because it is a way of approaching, when you're trying to hold a song together, how you hold it together harmonically and still make it fresh. Kern was a master at that.
Did you learn anything working with Bernstein and watching him work?
Oh, sure, a great deal. Yes, mainly I learned something about courage. I learned Lenny was never afraid to make big mistakes. He was never afraid to fall off the top rung of the ladder. And I learned by implication that the worst thing you can do is fall off a low rung. If you're going to make a mistake, make a huge one.
Now, you've talked about George Gershwin and Harold Arlen as great influences on you, and they were both very influenced by jazz. Did you listen to much jazz or pop when you were in your formative years?
Nope, I didn't, and I'm not very influenced by jazz. First of all, the whole idea of jazz is improvisation and instrumentalists. And because I'm only a piano player and have never played in a band, I don't have a feeling for that. Also, I think by nature I'm too conservative. I only improvise at the piano when I'm writing a song by myself. I never improvise for anybody else or in front of anybody else or at a party or anything like that. And I don't think I would be good at it. I'm much too constrained. It's partly my training. I was my first music teacher, who was a professor at Williams College, who was a very, very kind of Mary Poppins kind of teacher. With, you know, he laid down the rules, and that appealed to me a lot. The idea of rules of how you write music. That is to say, what music consists of, that it's not just sitting and waiting for an inspiration, but that you take a melodic idea that you have that might be an inspiration, but then you develop it and you work with it and work it out. You don't just fiddle around at the piano to do it. And that appealed to me a lot, but that's very conscious composition, and that's also what I studied with Milton Babbitt. And that is the reverse of jazz. In fact, it's always struck me so odd that Milton, who is so knowledgeable about composition and composes according to a set of rules, some of which he makes up himself, is also such a jazz fan. I can never put those two things together. At any rate, no, I was not influenced by jazz. I was influenced by Gershwin's and Kern's and Arlen's songs, and particularly by their use of harmony.
Was there any pop music that did make a big impression on you when you were young?
Well, you see, I wasn't exposed to a lot of pop music. You know, there were not a lot of records in the house, and when I listened to radio, it wasn't to music; it was to comedy shows and melodramas. So my exposure to songs was almost exclusively movies and theater. And so I grew up on theater and movie songs, not on pop songs. Hmm. And I was not somebody who liked to go to dances, so I didn't get to, you know, hear the big bands very often, except, again, when they were in movies. And so the answer is no, I didn't hear much pop music.
Now, another question about your formative years. You went to a Quaker school, but you also went to the New York Military Academy.
And yeah, that was earlier.
I can't imagine you being a cadet. And I know there's also an emphasis on athletics at the school. I went on the website, and it said all cadets must participate in sports throughout the year. So what was it like
for
you to be?
Well, first of all, I went when I was 10 years old.
Oh, okay.
10 and 11 years old. Only those 2 years. So yeah, I think you may have the wrong picture of me. And it was also because my parents had just divorced, and military school was always considered a place to send kids of divorced parents. A lot of my classmates were kids of divorced parents. And it was a lifesaver, because your life becomes chaotic suddenly when your parents split up. And military school is bringing order to chaos. You have to be at a certain place at a certain time. You have to polish the buttons on the uniform. You have to parade here. You have to take orders there. And it was wonderful. There's a sense of structure. And I think psychologically it must have saved my life.
You know, that actually really fits into what you were talking about wanting rules and structure in music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Order out of chaos. Order out of chaos. That's why I like crossword puzzles. Order out of chaos.
Right, right, right.
I think that's what art's about anyway. I think that's why people make art.
To create order in a world
chaos,
that's chaotic.
Yeah. the world has always been chaotic. Life is unpredictable. There is no form. And making forms gives you solidity. I think that's why people paint paintings and take photographs and write music and tell stories and that have beginning, middles, and ends, even when the middle is at the beginning and the beginning is at the end.
Stephen Sondheim, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure.
And happy belated 80th birthday.
Thank you, Terry.
Stephen Sondheim recorded in April 2010, a couple of weeks after his 80th birthday. He died November 26th at the age of 91. A few months after the interview we just heard, I got the chance to interview him again. This time, the occasion was the publication of his book, Finishing the Hat, collecting his lyrics from 1954 to 81 and telling the stories behind them. We'll start with a song from the show that launched his Broadway career, West Side Story, the musical that Steven Spielberg has adapted into a film that opens this month. Sondheim wrote the lyrics, Leonard Bernstein wrote the music. This is the Jet Song.
When you're a jet, you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, if the spit hits the fan, you got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own. When company's expected, you're well protected. Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you stay a jet.
I asked Stephen Sondheim how he went about writing lyrics for a show with street gangs singing and dancing to show tunes.
I was just imitating Arthur Lawrence's style. Arthur wrote the book, and he made up a style, a kind of street talk that never existed, because he knew that if he used actual street argot, it would date so quickly that by the time the show got on, a year or two later, it would be old-fashioned. So, one of the very few pieces of actual street argot we used was the word cool, which still meant the same thing back in 1957 that had meant to jazz musicians earlier. And that's a word that has stayed pretty much in the language, meaning approximately the same thing, although it changed a little bit. Now, of course, it just means okay. But cool meant better than okay before. But virtually everything else, the way that characters talk, Arthur made up, highly romanticized and very simply flowery for the young lovers, and for the gangs, a kind of made-up slang.
So one of the things I love about your book is that you not only tell the stories about the songs, you reprint the lyrics for alternate songs, for songs that you wrote before the final song was written or chosen. And you do that with the Jet Song. There were a couple of songs that you'd written lyrics for that weren't used.
There were two that were written, and then another one which was to replace the Jet Song that we wrote in Washington. So there were three, two prior to the show going to Washington, one after, and we decided to keep the Jet Song.
So would you read us a few lines from one or two of those alternate lyrics and tell us what you were trying to do there that was different from what you did in the Jet Song?
Oh, well, I wasn't trying to do anything different than I was trying to do in the Jet Song. Here, for example, here are a couple of lines from Mix, which was the name of a song that we wrote, which was the second attempt at an opening song. The first attempt was a long, rambling combination of dialogue and lyrics that took place in a clubhouse that the Jets had, and they were reading comic books and doing push-ups and clowning around, and they imagined a trip to the moon, and the whole thing was a sort of fantasy, and it was just too kid-like for the opening. So we decided on something more menacing and gang-like, and this is almost like a rumble song, and the lines go, mix, make a mess of them. Pay the Puerto Ricans back, make a mess of them. If you let us take a crack, there'll be less of them. There'll be less of them.
And then there's another song that you wrote lyrics for called This Turf Is Ours.
That's the one we wrote in Washington, and that was because people felt that mix was too violent. So we wrote the Jets song, which is very mildly threatening and menacing. And we got to Washington, and then everybody sort of felt that maybe it was a little too gentle. So we wrote something called This Turf Is Ours. This turf is ours, drew a big white line with a keep-out sign, and they crossed it. This turf is ours. Got to hold our ground, or we'll turn around, and we've lost it. And so we eventually decided the Jets song was the best of the bunch, and that's what we capped it.
Now, the song ends with, you know, we're going to beat every hole. Every whole buggin' gang on the whole buggin' street on the whole buggin' ever-lovin' street. Did you want to use the F word there?
Oh, sure. I wanted this to be the first musical to use and, in fact, I first used it in Krupke. I wanted the last line of Krupke to be, gee, Oscar Krupke, you. And we played the song for the head of the record company, Columbia Records, Goddard Lieberson, who's going to do the album, and also for a lady who was raising money for the producer at the time, and she blanched visibly and clearly was upset by it. She didn't complain. She just was sort of shocked and unhappy. But then Goddard told us that if we used that word, we couldn't ship the record across state lines because it would be in violation of the obscenity laws. So we changed it to Krupp U. Of course, I had wanted in the Jets song to be when the hits the fan, not when the spit hits the fan, and on the whole, mother loving of the mother street. But the audience understood exactly what we were saying. It did kind of make it a little kid-like. And then when we did the revival this last year, and Arthur decided to utilize Spanish for the Sharks sometimes to speak, that they would speak to each other in Spanish, he wanted to make it more, quote, realistic, and that's what led to that. And along those lines, I thought, well, if it's going to be more realistic, then let's use f***ing And the trouble is that the rest of the script is not in that style. When the dialogue is going on, they never use four-letter words. Therefore, for the lyrics to have used four-letter words would have been completely out of style and a sort of showing off for its own sake. If I had my choice, we would have used it just once in the original, just on you instead of Krupp you, and everything else would have remained the same. I wanted it to be sort of just the one shock moment. But as I say, we couldn't have shipped the record across state lines in those days.
You have some fascinating comments in your book about lyricists whose work you really admire and lyricists. I think our listeners will be surprised to hear you have a lot of criticisms of their work. And what surprised me the most was to read your criticisms of your mentor, Oscar Hammerstein. And had you shared those criticisms in public before? Is this kind of
I'd never in public. Not at all. But since I was writing a book that is critical of my own work, I wanted to show the standards by which I write my own lyrics. And it seemed to me, curious enough, I had thought when I first began the book, I thought, I will not criticize anybody else. I will only criticize my own stuff. Well, that is in its own way the mirror image of self-aggrandizement. Self-depreciation is just the other side of the coin. It's all about me, 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 me. And I thought if I don't put it into context of other people's work and show what I admire and what I don't admire about my predecessor's work. I never talk about anybody living in the book, only about people who are dead, because it doesn't hurt their feelings. And also, they can't fight you back. But but mostly, I really disapprove of people who criticize, particularly practitioners who criticize other practitioners while they're alive. I think that's really bad form, because it always hurts. But I thought, you know, I can't just criticize myself. So I looked very carefully, as I always have, at, you know, the dozen best lyric writers in the American musical theater who preceded me, and look at their work carefully and talk about it a little bit.
Well, let me choose a couple of Hammerstein examples that you cite in the book. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. You like that a lot.
Well, it's not that. I point that's not a question of whether like it or not. That's an example of how you underwrite a lyric. He knows that that doesn't read very excitingly on paper. But he also knows that when Rodgers puts it to music, it soars. That's a perfect example because lyrics are not poetry. They have to have air. They have to give music room to give them life. They can't just be self-contained. That's why they're lyrics and not poetry, and they're not light verse either. Lyrics are not meant to be read. They're meant to be sung.
Now, you contrast that. Oh, I should preface this by saying the last time you were on our show, you talked about the, you know, really interesting harmonic changes in the Jerome Kern song, All the Things You Are, for which Hammerstein wrote the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And but you very critical of Hammerstein's lyrics to the song, such as the line, you are the promised kiss of springtime that makes the lonely winter seem long.
Take the next line. Go ahead. Read it again. Read the second line. Because that's the one that clinches it.
Oh, okay. You do it.
You are the promised kiss of springtime that makes the lonely winter seem long. You are the breathless hush of evening that trembles on the brink of a lovely song. Those are all very pretty words, but what do they mean? Take a look at that image, those images. I don't know what they mean. And I also don't know how they apply personally to anybody. Oscar did a lot of poetic lyric writing, which I would call poesy, using images that I think are not germane to what's going on. I think it's just a writer trying to be poetic. And that's an example.
Now, in your sidebar about Ira Gershwin in your book, you describe him as rhyming poison. So,
no, I don't describe him as rhyming poison. I describe that as an aspect of his writing.
Okay. And you say he makes you feel the sweat. He's often undone by his passion for rhyming, for which he sacrifices both ease and syntax. And you offer as an example an excerpt of the song, How Long Has This Been Going On? Neath the stars at bazaars, often I've had to caress men. $5 or $10 then, I'd collect for all those yes men. Don't be sad, I must add, that they meant no more than chess men. Comments on that?
Well, I don't need to comment on it. It's complete nonsense. It makes the ear tired to listen to. It's so jammed with inner rhymes. And it is so a bleak way of saying something apparently simple, though I'm not even quite sure what he means by it. But it is all, you just feel the lyric writer sweating over every line with his rhyming dictionary. You can crossing out. I mean, that is such effortful writing. And then when it's sung, it makes the listener work as hard as the lyric writer did. Yes, I find that, you know, all too common in his lyrics.
You loved Dorothy Fields and knew her, didn't even realize she was a songwriter till you were in your teens. And your father introduced her to the man who became her husband.
Yes, it was his best friend.
And you love lyrics of hers that are very colloquial, like Sunny Side of the Street.
Yeah, again, simple. It seems so simple. You hear lyrics like that and you think, oh, I could write one of those. Well, you couldn't. And it's all the effort that goes into making something sound effortless, which is a kind of art that I like. Not all art has to seem effortless, you know. You see Guernica, it's not effortless. But you read War and Peace, it's not effortless. But I think with lyrics, popular songs, by popular I mean show songs, you should always not be aware of the writer. I think you should be aware of the character. And not think of the songs as written. Dorothy had a wonderful line in what I would call simple lyrics. I mean, her lyrics are so clean and so uncluttered and so seemingly effortless. And as we all know, it takes a huge amount of work to make something seem like there was no work in it at all.
Let's get to your musical, A Little Night Music. And I want to play Send in the Clowns. And I'll confess to you, this is a song. I love your songs. This is a song I never really felt much warmth for. I just never connected with it. And then seeing it in context in the show, I fell in love with it and then just kind of went back to the cast recording, original cast recording, and started listening to it over and over again with Glynis Johns singing it. And you tell a very interesting story about how you wrote this song for her, playing to her strengths and weaknesses. Can you talk about that?
The leading lady in the show is supposed to be charming and beautiful, beautiful enough even though she's entering middle age, to be a rival to a beautiful young 18-year-old girl. That's the idea of the triangle of the show. And we knew that in order to get somebody like that who would have charm and beauty and be able to play light comedy, because it's very elegant, the writing of the libretto, Hugh Wheeler's writing requires somebody who really knows how to play light comedy, and there aren't a lot of people who can do that, or couldn't in those days, and none now, because the whole fashion had gone out. I assumed, anyway, that whomever we would hire would not be able to sing very well, because to get all those qualities and a singer, certainly nobody sprang to mind, and the chances of finding somebody like that were slight. So I put all the vocal weight on Frederick, the hero, and on Anne, the young wife, the 18-year-old. And Desiree, the middle-aged lady, I had her take part in two numbers in the first act, both of which are essentially comic and do not require any heavy singing. And I knew that Glynis had this lovely, smoky, silvery voice, but she couldn't sustain notes. She's not really a singer. She's an actress who can sing very nicely, but not with a capital S singing. So I decided to write a series of short musical lines so she wouldn't have to sustain notes. And that suggested questions, little phrases. And then I wanted not to have any open vowel sounds at the end of the opening line so that it wouldn't seem like she couldn't sing. But you take a word like rich, it cuts itself off and has a short vowel sound. So if somebody sings, "Isn't it rich?" you don't expect them to sing, "Isn't it rich?" Whereas if it's an open vowel sound, you know, "Isn't it love?" If she went, "Isn't it love?" you could accept it, but you also know that it could be sustained. Rich can't be sustained without ruining the word. So it sounds like it fits the short phrase and it fits her voice. So it was tailoring it that way.
So this is Glynis Johns from the original cast recording of A Little Night Music singing Send in the Clowns.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clowns. Isn't it bliss? Don't you approve? One who keeps tearing around, one who can't move. Where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I'd stopped opening doors, finally knowing was yours, making my entrance again with my usual flair, sure of my lines, no one is there. Don't you love the fire? My fault, I fear. I thought that you'd want what I want. Sorry, my dear. But where are the clowns? Quick, send in the clowns. Don't bother, they're here.
The interview we heard with Stephen Sondheim was recorded in October 2010 after the publication of his book, Finishing the Hat. He died November 26th at the age of 91.
my timing this late in my career? And where are the clowns? There ought to be clowns. Well, maybe next year.
A film treasured by Sondheim fans has been reissued by the Criterion Collection on DVD and for streaming. Here's the story. In 1970, Sondheim's musical company broke most of the conventions of American musical theater. And now, more than a half a century later, a new London production is in previews in New York and is opening on Broadway December 9th, breaking even more rules with some startling changes of gender. One of the most significant landmarks in the show's history was its original cast album, and the making of that album is the subject of the documentary. The new reissue has some great new material. Our classical music critic, Lord Schwartz, has a review.
Before Company opened on Broadway, Stephen Sondheim was already well enough known for his lyrics to West Side Story and Gypsy and his hit show A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum for his new musical to be included in a series of TV documentaries on the making of original cast recordings. The only one ever completed turned out to be D.A. Pennebaker's original cast album Company. And it was a revelation. With its multi-layered title, is Company a corporation, someone coming to visit, a theatrical troupe? The show was something entirely new, even for Sondheim. On a bonus track for the new release of the documentary, he calls it a musical without a plot, with songs that comment on rather than contribute to the action. Based on a series of short plays by George Firth, Company is a love letter, or love-hate letter, to New York, mostly a string of satirical encounters by the chronically single Bobby with his pro-marriage friends.
It's not so hard to be married.
It's much the simplest of crimes.
It's not so hard to be married.
I've done it 3 or 4 times.
It's people that you hate together.
Hate together.
That makes marriage a joy.
It's like using force together, shouting kill your horse together.
Getting a divorce together.
That makes perfect relationships.
Kiss.
Okay, that's good. I want to do it once more.
Sondheim always wanted to be considered a composer, not just a lyricist. When I saw Company in its pre-Broadway Boston tryout, the music and lyrics struck me as most original when they were deliberately imitating familiar musical traditions, and always with a Sondheim twist. The love duet played for comedy. The classic side-by-side friendship song turned into a top hat and cane vaudeville routine. But Sondheim's satire always has the darkest undercurrents. His showstopper for Broadway legend Elaine Stritch, The Ladies Who Lunch, mocks the smart set of women on the go. Sondheim calls them dinosaurs surviving the crunch. Everybody tries, Stritch sings. Look into their eyes and you'll see what they know. Everybody dies. In Boston, Sondheim replaced Bobby's final song with Being Alive, his answer to Everybody Dies. Remember Adam Driver's piercing performance of it in Marriage Story? In Pennebaker's documentary, we're riveted by Sondheim the perfectionist trying to make sure this cast album is the definitive document of his score. The recording session took over 18 hours. But the most intense drama comes when Pennebaker zeroes in on the show's two musical focal points. Dean Jones, who played Bobby, had asked Elaine Stritch if he could record his climactic song earlier in the session when his voice would be less tired. And Stritch, nervous about her own big number, agreed. Pennebaker practically pushes the camera down Jones's throat. After the last take of Being Alive, the whole company gives Jones a round of applause. We feel his exhaustion.
Somebody crown me with love. Somebody push me to care. Somebody make me come through. I'll always be there, as frightened as you, to help us survive.
Boy, the number is a killer. Would you like to hear it?
When Stritch finally records The Ladies Who Lunch, she's electrifying, very much the way I remember her doing it on stage. But something bothers Sondheim. He and the recording engineer complain that she's speaking the song more than singing it. The more retakes they request, the more frustrated Stritch gets. She knows she's not giving Sondheim what he wants. He decides to record the orchestra without her and have her come back the next day to sing over the pre-recorded track. It's a harrowing episode. We watch her leave the studio defeated. But when she returns in the morning refreshed, she nails it.
Another chance to disapprove. Another brilliant singer. Another reason not to move. Another vodka singer. I'll drink to that. So here's to the girls on the go. Everybody tries. Look into their eyes and you'll see what they know. Everybody dies. A toast to that invincible bunch. The dinosaur surviving the crunch. Let's hear it for the ladies who lunch. Everybody rise.
That's great. That's one hell of a good take. I want you to come.
Another special feature of the Criterion disc is a 2019 mockumentary about the cast recording of a fictional Broadway flop called Co-op, which has some remarkable similarities to Company. Former Saturday Night Live writer and actress Paula Pell, belting a song called I Gotta Go, gives a lethal impersonation of Stritch. It even has its own making-of bonus track. Both the Company and Co-op documentaries, in their own way, take us behind the scenes and make us experience the real drama of putting on a show.
Lloyd Schwartz is the Frederick S. Troy Professor of English Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. His latest book is called Who's On First? New and Selected Poems. He reviewed the Criterion Collection's reissue of original cast album Company. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering today from Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.